Thanksgiving Eve edition. This is Lou, and I am joined by a very special guest tonight. We have the one-man revolution, the guerrilla scholar warrior, the Renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast.
Hey, Lou, it's great to be with you on the radio, and I guess I feel like I should say something like long-time listener, first-time caller, or something like that.
Long-time caller, first-time listener.
Yeah, long-time something.
So, you've had the Dangerous History Podcast going a little over a year so far, right?
Yeah, close to a year and a half.
Okay. Yeah, and I think I've caught every single episode with the exception of your interview with the Italian gentleman. I was listening to it and fell asleep to it, so I'm about halfway through it.
Okay.
No, seriously, I put on podcasts to fall asleep at night, and I absorb them through osmosis.
Yeah, that happens to me sometimes. Not that the podcasts aren't interesting, but, you know, it's just kind of soothing to have somebody talking to you while you're drifting off.
Yeah, it's a great way to go and absorb everything through osmosis. And I should remind everybody that the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except for governments. For more information, go to BIPCOT.org. And pretty soon the Dangerous History Podcast will be covered under BIPCOT, right?
Yeah, I just keep meaning to throw it on there and just keep forgetting, keep getting distracted by various goings on.
Trust me, I understand that. I get distracted all the time. But anyway, So let's get to dangerous history. What exactly is dangerous history as far as you use it?
Yeah, well, I came up with it as the title for my podcast as just the most basic way to describe what I'm doing, or at least what I think I'm doing. I guess I leave it up to the listener to figure out if I'm doing it or not. But I consider something dangerous history if it's something having to do with history that's either a topic or a perspective or both that is dangerous from the perspective of those in power and sort of the institutions of power, and that's also potentially liberating or empowering to the individual. That's what I would consider dangerous history. So it could be a topic that's dangerous because of what it is. You know, a particular story in history that few people know that might change the way they see things, the way they look at the powers that be, including the state. Or it could be dangerous because it's a perspective. Like, let's say it's a war in history that everybody knows about or everybody thinks they know about. But when you bring in points of view and perspectives and angles on things that are totally different from the standard narrative. So pretty much anything that really challenges the established narrative, you know, the narrative favored by the powers that be, I would consider dangerous history.
All right, and you are an actual history professor and teach at an actual college.
Yes, I do. And then I'm sort of like, you know, Batman podcaster at night. And I actually do some of the dangerous history stuff in my classes. I actually bring in, you know, a lot of the episodes I've done are taking things that I do in class and just, you know, really digging into them a lot deeper than I could in class because of time. So I actually do go off the beaten path a bit, but I started the podcast so that I could just go, you know, completely full-fledged off the reservation.
What are you planning on doing in the future as far as your outside of the classroom education and media expansion? Are you planning on doing any books, maybe write a book or do an audiobook to go with it?
I actually do have some potential books in mind. None of them are really like close to being done or anything like that. The one that I think I've mentioned on the show was The New Counterculture, writing some sort of book on that. And I did an episode about that, this sort of new kind of rejecting the system, libertarian, but like there's more to it than just that. All the people who are looking to sort of opt out of the institutions of control as they exist right now, I consider that to be like a new counterculture. And so that's something I've toyed with the idea of writing a book on, and I have, like, you know, notes and things accumulated for that, but still got a long way to go towards completion. And then there's some other books, you know, of just history rather than current events that I've kind of got in various stages of planning. But yeah, that's a strong possibility down the road.
Alrighty. I had a question from a listener about the counterculture, and we have to find it here in my notes somewhere. But okay. Let's get down to the basic taglines. I felt like a boxing announcer introducing you. you actually did an episode on this. And before I go into this, one of the things I really like about your podcast, and incidentally, your podcast has become the new Bad Quaker podcast for me, because that was something that Ben was putting out episodes darn near every day for a while. So my routine when I got home from work was to go to badquaker.com, which you can still go there, and for all the listeners, and I would see what Ben had put up that day. So I did not miss an episode, and I was actively looking for it. But what I really like about yours is just the variety of different things that you have in there. It's not like your specialty is the Revolutionary War and you're doing a 6,000-episode series on it. There's a lot of other things, some of it just being thoughts and ideas, and maybe even some theories. But
I like to be all over the place. I guess I'm one of those ADD people who, you know, I'm often reading 10 or 12 books at once. Of course, that means it takes me forever to finish any of them. But yep. I like to kind of, you know, dabble all over the place. And one of the things I find is that by studying lots of different things, that then you see connections and you learn things in one field that apply to something else. And I think a lot of people in sort of conventional academia are kind of stunted because they're so specialized. You know, they're in this one little niche where they know everything, but then they're clueless about anything outside that.
Okay, yeah, and you did an episode, and I'm not sure if the title was The Guerrilla Scholar Warrior, but if you could explain that in a little bit more detail, because when you did talk about it, I found it really fascinating.
Yeah, sure. That's a concept that I sort of put my own modern spin on. It's a concept of what's called a scholar warrior, which goes back to ancient Chinese Taoist philosophy that I'm a big fan of Taoism. And it's a close relative Zen Buddhism as well. And one of the concepts that you find coming out of Taoist thought is a scholar warrior. And what it means is a really well-rounded person who cultivates knowledge and skill in a variety of fields. So, like, maximizing your own versatility. And so in that episode you're talking about, I think I first just sort of like went through and talked about Taoism a bit, because, you know, a lot of Americans wouldn't have a clue what it is. And then I talked about the scholar warrior concept, and then I talked about the guerrilla scholar warrior concept as sort of my modern spin, because, like so many of us, you know, I've got a 9-to-5 job, I've got kids, mortgage, the whole bit, you know, lots of stuff to do. I wish I could spend 15 hours a day studying things, cultivating skills. And, you know, the idea is to really have a variety. So you would be, you know, perhaps a musician, but you would also know how to fight. And maybe you would also, you know, be reasonably skilled at other things, arts or whatever, and also have a depth of knowledge about a variety of topics. But like everyone else, I'm short on time, I'm busy, I'm running around. So my thinking is to just add guerrilla to it, because I've always been fascinated by guerrilla warfare. And what I mean by it is sort of making do with what you have in terms of time and resources. Not all of us have the ability in terms of time and money to, like, spend all day learning stuff. You know, we got work to do, we got chores to do, whatever.
Okay, and then also the Renaissance man for the new dark age, and we kind of chatted about this a little bit the other day. What do you see as being the new dark age? And we got about 2.5 minutes here.
Yeah, I think you actually summed it up way better than I did when we were talking about it. I kind of danced around it and rambled a little bit, but I thought you summed it up pretty well by just saying it's pretty much like the movie Idiocracy. there just seems to be, and it's of course not everybody. There's people that clearly buck this trend. I guess they'd be the new counterculture types, but there seems to be a sort of downward trend among many people these days in terms of. Basically just being intelligent and aware of what's going on and being plugged in and being intellectually curious. And the idea of the Renaissance is a rebirth of kind of bringing back maybe some of the good stuff that's been fading away, dispelling some of the darkness of the current dark age. So, all those titles that I used to have in the cruddy intro that I made myself with, like, no knowledge and skill of what I was doing. A lot of that stuff I meant kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I also meant, like, that's what I was striving for as far as, the guerrilla scholar warrior thing, the Renaissance man for the new dark age, trying to buck this trend of Idiocracy, I guess.
Yeah, it's really amazing if you're having a discussion with somebody, particularly on Face Beast. I don't know what it is. It just seems like there's a bunch of like partisan idiots on there, and you'll run into them anywhere. If you're talking about just any sort of historical subject, and their eyes start glazing over, and the bottom lip starts twitching, and they're just waiting for an opportunity to call Barack Obama a Muslim, which is completely irrelevant. And you talk about something going on, and their response is, well, those are Democrats there, or those are Republicans there. Really? I mean, what does that have to do with anything? And it's this very limited partisan tribalistic view of the world, and it's just absolutely ridiculous. And I really do see it as Idiocracy, but there's a whole lot more to the coming new dark age, and you and Bill spoke a little bit about it in your series with him, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But anyway, we'll be right back with more Freedom Fiends after this trip to the market.
Worms.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Admit it. You hate shopping for Christmas. You do. It's a hassle coupled with a burden, mechanically checking off friends, relatives, and coworkers from your list. You're probably not even religious, but if you are, is buying your cousin some little made-in-China piece of plastic really celebrating the birth of your savior? This holiday season, why buy gifts for friends and relatives? Most of them are statists anyway. You should send that money to the Freedom Fiends instead. The Freedom Fiends will use your money to help spread education of horizontal liberation throughout the world. If you want to help provide inoculation from indoctrination, go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post to send your money to the Fiends instead. Because buying crap for unappreciative statist relatives won't get your name on the golden floppy disk of redemption. And if you must shop for Christmas, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you anything extra, and Amazon will save you the danger of holiday drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon pretty much sells everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom, so get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com.
And welcome back. This is Lou, and I am joined by our special guest tonight, Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast. Hey. And you've done podcasts on the collapse of the Bronze Age, I believe it was, a couple different collapses in throughout history. And then you also talked about the Dark Ages, too. And what was really involved with all that stuff? Because like when it comes to the collapse of Rome, it didn't happen overnight. Rome didn't collapse in a day, and it had this slow spiraling death roll.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, with the benefit of hindsight, you can actually see it coming a long way off, you know, since we know now what to look for, especially those of us who actually have somewhat of a grasp of good economics, you know, non-Keynesian economics, that, I mean, you can see it coming a mile off. Even a few centuries before the collapse was obvious to everybody, you can already look at things like price inflation and just the economy getting increasingly hobbled by taxes and regulations and all that sort of stuff. So it's amazing how, I mean, you could see these things coming a mile off. So, you know, you're looking around now and you see a lot of similar patterns. It seems like something's on the way. But when these collapses happen, whether you're talking about the Roman Empire or the kind of Mediterranean Bronze Age civilizations way back in the 12th century BC, everybody always wants to blame these sort of external kind of black swan sort of events. You know, they want to blame ecological problems or, you know, earthquakes or volcanoes or a scary hairy barbarian showing up at the gates or something like that. And the reality is that those kinds of horrible mishaps are happening to civilizations like all the time. And so when you see a pretty sophisticated civilization suddenly have a complete backward slide in terms of technology and literacy and standard of living and all that, there's got to be something else going on besides just, you know, bad weather and scary barbarians, because those things are almost like a constant throughout history.
How would you compare events that are happening today with, let's say, the fall of the Roman Empire or the Bronze Age collapse?
Yeah, well, with the Bronze Age collapse, it's a little bit different, because as far as I've been able to tell in my readings on that, there wasn't really anything resembling an economy as we would think about it, where it's all on specialization and division of labor and money and that sort of thing. Like trade was very state controlled back during the Bronze Age, and in fact in most kingdoms, like, there was a lot of central planning. I mean, your local king would probably tell you, if you were a farmer, like what to plant and when to plant it. I mean, micromanaging it even worse than the USDA does. So there you've got a very centrally planned situation. Rome's a little bit more analogous to us in terms of its economy, because you do have money, you do have long-distance trade and specialization and all that. And so you've got a somewhat comparable situation going on, where over time the Roman state keeps wanting to pay for more war and more social programs simultaneously. And they just want to keep expanding their territory, their military. All this requires more bureaucrats to run everything. They cost money too. And so Rome eventually hit on the ancient version of having the Fed print money. The ancient version of having the Fed print money is to take silver coins and basically dilute them with like tin or something worthless like that. So they're doing the old-fashioned version of money printing, and it has similar effects to what it does today. It drives up prices, it causes all sorts of dislocations throughout the economy, and then the politicians do what they usually do, which is blame everybody but themselves for the fact that prices are going up, and they respond with, you know, price controls, draconian price controls. The Emperor Diocletian was famous for this, and then, of course, people will dodge those. There'll be black markets. Oftentimes, it's the only way to get stuff. And then they'll respond with draconian punishments for that, anti-hoarding laws. And, it just strangles the economy. It really strangles the economy. And eventually, you end up in a pretty bad place for everybody as far as standard of living goes.
So as far as, like, the Bronze Age collapse, that was more Soviet Union. And then as far as the collapse of the Roman Empire, that's more 20th and 21st century America then.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy.
All right, we'll be back. More Freedom Fiends after this trip to the market.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Anti-war, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Freedom Fiends. So with the Dark Age, one of the things that was common with the Dark Age was that it was basically a stop of forward progress. There wasn't a whole lot of technology that was being created, and I think we were just really, really stagnant. How long did that last, and how did that impact folks?
Well, I guess the real heart of the Dark Ages would be at least a couple of centuries, if not a bit more. People oftentimes will talk about Charlemagne having a little bit of a renaissance kind of during his time period, where things went forward again for a while, and then they kind of seesawed back and forth for the remainder of the Middle Ages. But you had at least a few centuries of initially progress and material comfort, and all that actually goes backwards dramatically, and then is kind of stagnant, and then takes its sweet time catching back up to what it was, you know, when the Roman Empire was still, you know, more or less intact, and the Roman state wasn't being too much of a predator on the economy. So it really did go backwards, though, in a lot of ways that you can actually measure in archaeology. So everything from population of cities falls off, I mean, just drastically. A lot of the cities in Western Europe reduced in population by, you know, 80% or more. Number of acres being farmed drops off dramatically. Archaeology shows that even things like the size of livestock animals declined during the Dark Age. And every type of material good becomes either non-existent or becomes more rare, and what you find is less quality. So, you know, things like pottery, for example, where usually that's one of the things that, you know, I'm not an archaeologist, but I like to learn from the work of, you know, these people who will sit and study shards of pottery and figure out, like, how old is it, how well made is it, and all that stuff. Things like that become less common, and when you do find it, it's not as nice, it's not as well made. So, I mean, there's a drastic backward step in everyone's material standard of living and well-being for at least a bunch of generations before it starts to gradually come back.
That pop in or drop in population that you mentioned, was that due to starvation? Was it die-offs, or was it just a lack of reproduction?
I think it was a combination of a lot of things. I think it was a combination of people maybe not reproducing as much because of the chaos and instability, especially in the times real close right after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. And then, you know, you're not farming as much. That's going to mean that food is more scarce. That's going to mean that even if you do have a bunch of kids, fewer of them are going to live to adulthood than would have when times were better. You do have, you know, chaos, marauding barbarians coming in from the Eurasian steppe, and you have epidemic diseases. You know, all these things kind of, once the dominoes get falling enough, everything sort of piles on, and it just, you know, gets worse and worse.
I think the modern version of what you're describing from the Dark Ages would be the more entangling tentacles of the state when it comes to commerce and the economy in general, with all the regulation. Because when you look at food production, we've talked about this a lot here on the show, it a lot of the small family farmers are getting messed with, and it's leaving just the large corporate farms. But in a situation like that, if you have large corporate farms and you have a disease that goes through there and it takes out a bunch of the herd or the flock or whatever it is that they're raising, you'll have a lot less food that's available. And it seems like those marauding barbarians are wearing badges and funny costumes. So
and some of them were, you know, back in when the Roman Empire, the Western Roman Empire, still existed but was in bad shape. There was a tendency to, the worse the economy got, the more the Roman state would become predatory upon it. So it was like a case of a parasite that's just way out of hand and actually is devouring the host, not really apparently thinking through that if I devour the host, then I'm kind of out of luck too.
So sort of like FDR in the New Deal.
Yeah, that, but just like, you know, keep stepping on the gas until it all just comes crumbling down.
Yeah. Now, you've also done a lot of different podcasts on different wars, wars that people aren't really familiar with. You've talked about the Seminole Wars. What else is in there? Oh, something that you mentioned in your discussion with Bill Buport, and I'd never even heard of it until this came up. I guess in 1871 was the first war against Korea.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I'm not that familiar with it. I had heard just enough of it that when Bill asked something about it, I was able to sound real smart by piping in with, "Oh yeah, Korea." but I actually don't know a whole lot about it, other than it was I think a very short-lived sort of abortive expedition. But yeah, there's so many cases of, you know, just talking about American history, of these little wars that most people are clueless about. Like, how many people know that under the great Woodrow Wilson, not only did the United States get into World War I, but also under Woodrow Wilson, the United States was sending military forces into Mexico, into Haiti, into like at least a dozen other Latin American and Caribbean countries. You know, oftentimes small numbers, just a little Marine Expeditionary Force or whatever. But, you know, basically anytime some state in the Western Hemisphere did anything that U.S. government, which usually meant U.S. corporations, didn't like, they would just, you know, send in the troops and either just overthrow the government of these places or just threaten it to start behaving the way that Team America wants it to.
Yeah, and you even did a couple of episodes, America versus Democracy, I believe it was.
Oh, yeah, Uncle Sam versus Democracy, yeah.
Yeah, and you were talking about, what was it? Operation Ajax and then Operation PB Success. And Operation Ajax, that was Iran, right?
Yeah, that was overthrowing the relatively moderate, fairly secular, kind of modernizing government of Mohammad Mossadegh, which, you know, democratically elected by Iran, and shows you how America's commitment to democracy only endures so long as other countries are voting for people and programs that we like. But as soon as they elect someone that we don't approve of, then democracy is worthless.
And a lot of this stuff is, as you mentioned, based upon economics. With Operation PB Success, I was talking about incursions into Central and South America. As a matter of fact, the Fighting Quaker, Smedley Butler, in his book War's a Racket, he talked about how he was basically a hired gun for big business. So
And a lot of the stuff he's talking about are these operations, you know, some of them dating back to Wilson, like I said, and a lot of them just continued into the 1920s. And it's so difficult to untangle these things, because whenever I do an episode on, like the one, for example, on Guatemala, I run into the problem of, like, where do I start the record? Do I start it on this U.S. intervention to overthrow the government of Guatemala, or do I go back a decade or two to the last time that Uncle Sam went in there and overthrew their government, you know? Same thing I'm running into now. I'm working on a bonus episode for my Patreon supporters, and it's going to be on Operation Northwoods, which a lot of people have heard of, but not, you know, really dug into in detail. And I'm running into the same problem of, like, where do I drop the needle on the record as far as the tangled, twisted relationship between Team America and Cuba? I mean, you can go back 200 years to find. I think even Thomas Jefferson had a little bit of a covetous eye cast towards Cuba for a while.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I know a lot of Marines, having been in the military, and they all know who Smedley Butler is. They know him as the most decorated Marine, if not military person of all time. But very few of them know about his little book, War is a Racket. Very few have read it. I mean, this is just not something that they talk about in Marine Corps boot camp.
No, but it is something that I have my students read in my U.S. history classes. And, you know, I get a lot of veterans coming through my classes, you know, on GI Bill money and so on. And it's amazing. I would say about 90% of the time that a veteran in my class is, like, very, very much in agreement with what Smedley Butler has to say. And a lot of times when we're discussing War as a Racket in class, the veterans will chime in with personal anecdotes of things that they saw or that they did that fit with what Smedley Butler talks about in War as a Racket, as far as, like, you know, all the waste, the obvious profiteering taking place, the shoddy goods, the goods that are not helpful but keep getting ordered anyway, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, it's really amazing, because, I mean, as I said, I've talked to a lot of veterans, and a lot of them, they understand the whole racket thing, and they say the same things that you're talking about right there, but for some reason, most of them just can't go all the way to completely admit that the war that they fought wasn't about American freedom. It was a lie. It was a armed robbery writ large. And it's, I don't know, I just wonder, how do you get past that final hurdle with them?
Yeah, well, it depends. I've actually had a fair number of veterans come through my classes who, there have been a few exceptions, but they seem, many of them, to be very receptive to a lot of the ideas and points of view and perspective on history that I'm sharing. Like, a lot of them end up loving my class and taking a bunch of different classes with me. And, I mean, by the end, I don't know if they're all card-carrying anarchists or not, but by the end, a lot of them are really, you know, lean in that direction, it seems like to me anyway. It's only a small percentage I've had who are the ones who are just, you know, the unrepentant Team America cheerleaders.
All right, and we'll be back with more Freedom Fiends after this trip to the market.
Listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
Are you tired of governments murdering people around the world? Stop using their money. There is an alternative. Bitcoin is a stateless, free market, non-political currency. Bitcoin cannot be inflated or controlled by any government. By using their money, you are helping the state. Stop doing it. You have an incredible alternative available now. Learn it, use it, spread it. Get started with Bitcoin at Bitcoin.com. That's Bitcoin.com.
Freedom Fiends. Hey, this is Wood. I'm joined by Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast.
Hey.
So as far as your brand of dangerous history, because I know you you go over the stuff that is not typically taught in the government indoctrination gulags. For example, you probably don't talk about what a great humanitarian Abraham Lincoln was, or, you know, just any of the other dogmatic nonsense that goes along with it. How's the reception of your students been when they hear stuff that's contradictory to what they've been taught while growing up?
It's hard to say, because sometimes they're a bit poker-faced and you don't know for sure. Sometimes you can tell, though. Sometimes you can tell that they're not taking it well. And I always try to emphasize that, hey, I'm just trying to share as much true stuff with you in the semester I have, kind of like trying to do some cult deprogramming in a hurry. I'm trying to share as much stuff that I wish when I was 18 somebody would have told me, so that I wouldn't spend a bunch of years believing a bunch of stuff that's not true and wasting a lot of time and mental energy, chasing after ideals and things that aren't even real. But some of them, by the end, I don't know if it's that the Stockholm Syndrome kicks in or what, but some of them by the end of the semester are quite grateful that I've kind of, blasted them with enough red pill doses to wake them up. That Matrix metaphor, it's so cliched, but it really is true. I mean, some people are grateful to be woken up, and other people would rather have you just, keep slipping them blue pills.
Yeah. When I first heard, that Lincoln wasn't a great guy, it's like, no, the Emancipation Proclamation and all those speeches and everything else. And, because everybody's read the Gettysburg Address, but one of the things is, in school, we never studied, what was it, his first inaugural address, which was definitely not, how could I put it, very liberty-oriented, to say the least.
Yeah, that's the one where he basically says, look, I don't plan on messing with slavery anywhere that it already exists. I just want to make sure the South keeps paying those taxes.
Yeah, and he also invoked the fugitive slave laws, which are in the Constitution. And he even says, look, you go to the Constitution, it's clear as day, fugitive slave laws. And I think he kind of waffled on whether the states or the federal government should be enforcing it. But anyway, so yeah, for some reason, I don't want to get all conspiratorial and say that it's deliberate that we didn't read his first inaugural address, and we didn't read the Emancipation Proclamation. We just heard the, Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves, but it didn't free all the slaves. On a side note, I want to go to one of these Republican Lincoln Day dinners and say, in honor of our 16th president, I would like to read his first inaugural address, and then just watch all the jaws hit the floor.
Well, if you want to really throw people for a loop, go back just a couple years further. I think it was 1858 when he ran against Stephen Douglas for the Senate seat from Illinois. During the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates, that everybody likes to quote the lines Lincoln said in there about a house divided cannot stand, and everybody points to that and says, oh, look at this, how brave and idealistic he was, taking a stand against slavery. Isn't that nice? And then they leave out how often during those debates Lincoln would go on what today we would consider extremely racist rants, and would say things like, I, as much as any man, am in favor of the white race having the superior position. I mean, he said stuff like that on a regular basis while debating with Stephen Douglas.
Well, that's just some revisionist nonsense that you guys made up. So,
yeah.
With the state of education being what it is, and being controlled by government and being like all other government programs, how did you come across all this real history? I know you go to original sources, but how did you get exposed to that for the first time? Because that's not something that you get in the government indoctrination gulags.
Well, I can hear music coming in, so I don't know if I'll have time to answer that before we have to go to market.
All right. We'll go back to that in the second hour.
All right.
More Freedom Fiends coming up after this trip to the market.
Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Freedom Fiends, and we're back with the second hour. This is Lou, and I'm joined by our special guest, Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast. He is the guerrilla scholar warrior, the Renaissance man for the New Dark Age, and you can find his stuff at profcj.org. All right, in the last hour, we were so rudely interrupted by the music and going to break. Where did you come up with all this actual real history and everything else? How did you get exposed to that? Because, like we were saying, with the government indoctrination gulags, they don't cover all that stuff.
Yeah, well, I guess I maybe would give a little bit of credit to my parents for something. They actually were the type of people, I mean, they weren't, you know, libertarian unschoolers or anything like that, but they were people who did encourage me to, like, you know, pursue self-education. Like, they were always willing to give me a ride over to the libraries back, you know, pre-internet days and everything when I was a little kid, and encouraging me to just kind of, like, follow my own knowledge. So I sort of got an autodidact streak from them. And then for whatever reason, I don't know if it's genetic or what, Bill Buport said in one of the episodes I did with him on Irregular Warfare, that he believes that libertarianism is genetic, that some people are just born with that streak. And I don't know if it's genetics or that combined with life experience or what, but I think as far back as I can remember, I just always had the skeptical kind of troublemaker, or not believing the people with quote-unquote authority streak. And so when you put those two things together, being an autodidact and then having an anti-authoritarian streak, basically, I get interested in history just because it's interesting. And then as I'm learning, every now and then I come across some little thing that doesn't fit with what everyone else thinks. You know, I come across one little nugget, one little fact here, one little source here that says something that no one else seems to know, but seems to be backed up by evidence. It's true. And it just gradually, over many years, I kept accumulating these little, you know, tidbits here and there, and then kind of put it all together and said, okay, I guess the establishment's narrative is full of holes. And history made me an anarchist. I don't know how many other people can say that, but, like, just relentlessly pulling at the thread of the truth is what eventually led me to just give up on the whole idea of the state.
Yeah, I think history played a part for me. I think economics played a larger part. I do find it kind of funny that you would get dropped off at the library and maybe find somebody snuck in a copy of Murray Rothbard's Conceived in Liberty or something like that there. So, I guess that's a little bit subversive, too. But it's really amazing, though, because Frank Chodorov had written about, you know, libertarians are not created, they're born. And I don't know. I kind of got to question that a little bit, because growing up, I was very, I was into the authoritarianism, not being authoritarian, but I was raised to always obey and believe in everything else, and, you know, do as you're told, and all that other nonsense. And eventually, I started slipping out of that. So I don't know if that was conditioning that just didn't take, because probably around age 12 was when I started slipping away from that. But I know a fair number of people that were good, obedient citizens, and then eventually they're just like, oh, no, that's really not working so well because, you know, the truth and facts and stuff like that.
So. Yeah. I don't think there's any one path. You know, I think everybody, if they ever end up where we're at, comes about it on a different route. You know, this weird combination of probably some genetics going on just as far as how each individual's brain is wired. But then, you know, I think there's a life experience sort of element as well, that it's nature and nurture in a way.
Yeah, I think it comes down to being able to accept the truth, because you're talking about a Patrick Henry quote during the break.
Oh, and, it's one that I've got up on the wall of my classroom, actually, and occasionally if I'm, you know, sharing an unflattering story about, I don't know, some founding father or, heaven forbid, Honest Abe, occasionally I'll point at this one quote I've got up on kind of a little poster thingy I made, and it's from Patrick Henry. It's one of his lesser-known quotes, but it's, "For my part, whatever anguish of spirit it may cost, I am willing to know the whole truth, to know the worst, and provide for it." So that's kind of the approach that I took, is somewhere along the way, I just sort of surrendered to it, you know, to the reality. I said, you know what, regardless of how many sacred cows this is obliterating and how this might be hurting my feels, when there's just, you know, facts and evidence and so on that shows that what everyone believes isn't the truth or is, you know, far from the whole truth, I would rather just surrender to the truth and believe what is true, even if it's not always sunshine and lollipops, than to believe in sunshine and lollipops that are not true.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you talk about the Founding Fathers, because there's this idea that it was this homogenous group. They all got together. They had no differences, or any differences that they had were really minor, but they put those off to the side, and they came together to found this nation built on freedom and everything else. And it's completely the opposite of that. And most people have this dogmatic idea that, you know, hey, these special guys, you know, and really, they were just a bunch of power-hungry politicians. And you've covered the Revolutionary War, and then also Revolutionary Aftershocks. And then also in your Heroes and Villains series, you've talked about the most recent villain was Robert Morris, one of the founding lawyers. And essentially, it was, and the Constitution was a money laundering operation, or a money grab.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, when it comes to figuring out how to tax the American people more so that the government's debt that was, by that point, mostly snapped up by banksters like Robert Morris, so that those guys would get their, you know, full face value plus interest paid off on those loan certificates. And it's just incredible when you realize that Robert Morris, probably in the top two or three most important founding fathers, really, and yet he's one of the least known to the general public, and even people who are pretty knowledgeable about history, they know almost nothing about Robert Morris. If they do know anything, they're like, oh yeah, wasn't he sort of like the finance dude who kind of helped fund everything? And he was like almost the president, really, in the last two, 3 years of the American Revolution. He was like the finance czar of the Congress, and with that job came power that's just incredible. That people are just clueless about who he was and what he was really up to. So that was why I did that episode, because there's just this gap, you know, this one founding father who's sticks out even above the rest. And in a lot of ways, he's kind of the guy behind Alexander Hamilton, too.
Yeah, and Alexander Hamilton, and you and I were talking about this last week, and then also Tom Woods just recently had an episode on him. Ultimately, had he stayed out of politics, he might not have been such a bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at his early life, you know, he had made something of himself. He was a self-made guy, born in very, very humble circumstances, and apparently had a genius for business. But then, of course, he eventually goes to the dark side of politics. And I think there's a lot of people like that in history that seem like they're really cool guys until they decide to put on the Ring of Power, and then they suddenly turn into monsters.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that you covered, and this is something that most people don't think about, regarding the American Revolution, it actually started in 1775, and in 1776, when the Declaration of Independence had its magic words scribbled on it, and people signed it and everything else. Ultimately, that was just the politicians chasing a trend and trying to take credit for it. Okay, looks like we lost CJ. But anyway, what he had discussed in his podcast was that there were a number of incidents where people were rebelling against the crown, and they were basically engaging in disobedience and civil disobedience. For example, you had the Boston Tea Party, and much contrary to what people normally believe, it wasn't well received by the people of Boston. The Sons of Liberty were kind of pariahs over it, and it wasn't until the aftershocks, the response of
Fiend phone.
The British Fiend Crown phone. And the soldiers and everything else that were going out and doing reprisals against the citizens, that the Sons of Liberty actually gained a little bit of support, and then actually it turned into wide support, and that's part of what helped to launch the revolution itself. Are you back, CJ?
I am back. All right.
All righty. The internets are having fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was just talking about the Boston Tea Party and how the Sons of Liberty were not very popular over it, and it was the reprisals that got them going. But anyway, in the revolution basically started in 1775. So if you want to add a little something to that, go ahead.
Yeah, that was where the fighting broke out. That was when the people, especially in kind of the area of Lexington and Concord, in small town rural Massachusetts outside of Boston, that was when the people took up arms and started to shoot at what were the soldiers of the government under which they had all grown up as subjects of the British Empire. And there was nobody, when the fighting broke out in 1775, there was nobody in Philadelphia or any place else that was ordering these farmers, these average people, to do it. They were making the decision on their own. They were leading themselves.
Well, let's take it a little step further. I'm going to get a little seditious here, but the Redcoats were actually fulfilling the role of law enforcement in the colonies. So the Redcoats were actually cops, and you didn't have a heck of a lot of people screaming "Red Lives Matter."
Yeah, good point.
All right, more Freedom Fiends coming up after this trip to the market. Worms.
Listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Hey, this is Squisscar Squig Elves from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now. So there you go.
Tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
Pipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And ask me about my worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
And now they're bigger buttons.
They used to be 1¼ inch. Now they're 1¾ inch. Dan, they're bigger buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Freedom. So going back to the ratification of the Constitution, most people have this idea that it was these great men getting together and creating this more perfect union and all that other nonsense. And essentially it was a coup. And we talked about this a little bit in the last segment, but essentially it was a money grab with the power to tax and then also to pay off the war debt. If you could go into a little bit more detail on that, that'd be nice.
Sure, yeah. The Articles of Confederation didn't give the central government any power to tax. They basically could ask the states for contributions, and if the states didn't want to or didn't have the money, they, there was nobody going to come invade them if they didn't chip in. So you had a lot of war debt that was not likely to be paid off at full face value. So people who were heavily invested in that wanted that to get done, wanted to have a central government that could tax more. And then there were people who didn't even have a financial stake personally, but who just were already that early just inculcated with nationalist ideology. I found some good stuff, some good serious scholarly history articles about this when I was researching for the Robert Morris episode, that basically, even while the Revolutionary War was still winding down, Robert Morris, Alexander Hamilton, James Wilson, handful of other guys who later get known as the movers and shakers of the Federalist faction who got the Constitution written and passed, they were sort of already scheming, even before the Revolutionary War was over, about various ways to try to get a more centralized, more powerful federal government in place. And some of them stood to profit from it personally, but not all of them did. Some of them just simply believed in it ideologically. And, of course, George Washington was part of this group, too. So, in a way, they were sort of scheming for a long time. They initially tried to get their goals done within the Articles of Confederation system, but for various reasons they couldn't. And so eventually they decided just to do an end run around by tossing out the Articles system altogether and making a new one.
Yeah, and it's probably not a stretch to say that Shays' Rebellion had played at least a significant part in the constitutional coup of 1787, and then directly led to the Whiskey Rebellion in, what was that, 1794?
Yeah, 1794. And Shays' Rebellion is one of those things that most people, if they can even recall it at all, they sort of have a vague idea. Yeah, there was some angry debtors somewhere who didn't want to pay their debts or what have you. But yeah, I mean, that was a pretty serious thing as a portent of things to come and as an excuse for the Federalists to start pushing their ideas more. Supposedly, it was actually Shays' Rebellion specifically that caused George Washington to come out of retirement. He had been, at his home for a number of years ever since the war ended and he resigned his commission. And supposedly it was Shays' Rebellion specifically that caused George Washington to jump into American politics. And, he was a big force behind the Constitution. For a long time, people thought he really didn't have much to do with it directly because he didn't speak hardly at all at the Constitutional Convention. But in fact, he was exercising a lot of power and influence behind the scenes on what got done. And, everybody, including him, expected him to be the first president. And so he was making his preferences known as far as, what powers the presidency should have.
Yeah. Now, something interesting that you had discussed in the Revolutionary Aftershocks episodes, with Shays' Rebellion, one of the requirements was that the taxes be paid in hard currency, so meaning silver, and right. there was no silver available. So if you don't even have silver available, then you obviously can't pay for it, and the government was still expecting people to pay it even though there was no silver available.
Yeah, exactly. The people who were rebelling, quote-unquote, in Shays' Rebellion were primarily small to mid-sized farmers, and they were mostly in kind of the western counties of Massachusetts, which were the more sparsely populated and still kind of semi-frontier in a lot of ways. You know, we don't think of Massachusetts as being frontier, but back then, western Massachusetts was still pretty rough. And so even people who were kind of well off back then would have had a hard time simply finding any gold or silver anywhere available to pay these bills with.
And we'll be back with more Freedom Fiends after this trip to the market.
Wines!
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, "You didn't build that"? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Are you sick of peaceful people being locked away for victimless crimes? Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, consider taking it so you can do the right thing. A single juror with a conscience can send someone home to their family instead of to a jail cell. If there's no victim, how can there be a crime? And if the judge or prosecutor are keeping you in the dark, what are they trying to hide? You can vote your conscience instead of being a pawn of the state. For more information, Google jury nullification or check out the Fully Informed Jury Association at fija.org.
Freedom Fiends. Hey, this is Lou, and I'm talking to Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast. Looking at your Revolutionary War series and then also the history of irregular warfare that you did with Freedom Fiend Bill Buport, there's a lot of myth-busting going on in there, particularly with the Revolutionary War, the idea that you need this massive military, this conventional military force to go in and, you know, rout out the foreign invaders and all this other stuff, and that's really not true.
Yeah, what you find is that things like guerrilla fighters and militia and other sorts of, you know, non-professional, non-regular forces can actually be really effective and just can make no end of hassles and frustrations for a big standard conventional force. And, you know, all we have to do is look at someplace like Afghanistan, for example, to see how effective irregulars can be against regulars when they're fighting on their home court and they're using tactics that, you know, play to their strengths and play to the conventional opponent's weaknesses. So everybody wants to give credit to the Continental Army for winning the Revolutionary War, because, you know, the few big battles that the American side won in that war, it's the Continental Army winning those battles. But the militia really was what was just constantly harassing the British military and preventing them from getting anything worthwhile when they did win when the British did win a big battle or seize a city. You know, they seized Philadelphia, which was more or less the de facto capital of America at the time, and it didn't do really any big amount of good towards them winning the war. And they would just, you know, march into one place and take it and then start getting harassed by the militia, and, you know, the county next door would still be resisting. So it really was, in a lot of ways, a people's war.
Yeah, there was no head to cut off, basically.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. The whole idea of decentralized resistance. I mean, you did have the Continental Army itself, but basically, as long as they could avoid getting annihilated, and it was close a few times, but you know, George Washington didn't win many battles, but he did manage to make a few really slick evacuations at the last minute a few times there. Yeah.
Well, you know why George Washington never died in battle, right?
Why is that?
Because he could retreat a heck of a lot faster than the British could attack.
Yeah. And it began the grand American tradition of treating retreats as if they're still sort of victories. You know, you see that in the War of 1812. The British seized D.C., burned down the White House and the Capitol, but all we want to talk about is that Dolly Madison got the artwork out.
Yeah, and America is 0-2 when it comes to invading Canada. You know, yep. It's interesting because George Washington, one of the very few battles that he actually won was against Revolutionary War veterans during the Whiskey Rebellion. Not a good general at all.
That's right. And the army that he sent out to crush a handful of tax resistors in western Pennsylvania was larger than any army he commanded during the Revolutionary War against the British.
Yep. And you had even quoted a Russian, or not Russian, British flag officer, either general or admiral, that said that the Crown's war effort would be a whole lot smoother if the colonists had created a conventional military for them to go up against.
Sure, yeah. And that's something that a lot of people kind of know instinctively, that irregular warfare can be just devastatingly effective and frustrating to conventional forces. But even though a lot of people know this deep down, like, they don't want to face the implications of that, because then that calls into question a lot of things from history and a lot of the sacred cows of history right on up to the present. And, you know, what does Team America expect they're going to accomplish, you know, using a second-generation military to try and fight against fourth-generation opponents? You know, and that series with Bill was really great, because it was nice to talk to someone who is a genuine expert on all that stuff, who is not a hardcore statist, because most of the people out there who are at least alleged, you know, experts on irregular warfare and all that, I mean, they're usually neocons or something, you know, they're Max Boot or somebody like that.
They're a very special species. And Bill does have a graduate degree in resistance and rebellion. I love that he says that.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't have that at the college where I got my master's, or I probably would have opted for that.
Yeah, definitely. Something else that came up in the history of irregular warfare, and he addressed a lot of the fallacies. And one of them is the bomb them into submission, or kill enough of their family members to make them stop hating you.
Yeah, it doesn't work. Doesn't work. I mean, unless you're willing to go full bore genocide, like just flat out genocide. But anything short of that is simply going to strengthen the resistance, because the harder you crack down, the more people you drive into the arms of the resistance, or, you know, the terrorists from the perspective of the counterinsurgency force. And you see this again and again and again. The harder you crack down, the more you strengthen the resistance. You drive more people to join the active resistance, and you also drive a lot of civilians who before were kind of on the fence, maybe were just trying to stay out of it and just sort of live their lives. But, you know, people get friends, relatives, neighbors killed by foreign occupying forces. And suddenly, you know, maybe before that happened, they saw the insurgents in their neighborhood as kind of troublemakers that they didn't want to associate with. But,
like the Sons of Liberty.
Yeah, exactly. But man, when like half your family tree gets wiped out by the counterinsurgency force, suddenly you might take a different view and start helping them out with intelligence. Even if you don't become an active combatant yourself, you know, intelligence, supplies, other forms of support. And that's really what it comes down to, is when you're fighting an insurgency, you're fighting an entire people. And again, short of outright genocide, it's pretty tough to win that.
Yeah. I'd like to move on to some current events, also known as future history. And this is a listener question that I got earlier today. People were asking about the insanity of the Cold War. And if you're going to cover this on your show also, the insanity that is Cold War international relations at some point. And how would you compare the mess of entangling alliances with the events leading up to World War I with the current Middle Eastern crisis? Because the Turks just shot down a Russian fighter jet, and Turkey is part of NATO.
Yeah, and that is concerning, and that is disturbing, and it shows that the only thing that we learn from history is that it doesn't teach us anything. Because first I'll just say, when it comes to the Cold War, yeah, I'm going to cover more Cold War-related stuff. I might actually do an episode at some point on all the close calls and insanity in terms of nuclear holocaust almost happening repeatedly throughout the decades of the Cold War, and how close. You know, everybody knows about the Cuban Missile Crisis, but not everybody knows about all the times there were just like stupid accidents and radar malfunctions and things like this that almost caused thermonuclear holocaust.
But, or the launch codes being 8 zeros.
Yeah, the launch codes were all zeros for like 15 years in the toughest times of the Cold War, you know. So, I mean, this stuff is true. America almost nuked itself, at least one occasion I'm familiar with. And it was just a simple matter of the bomb didn't go off. But I think it was one of the Carolinas that was accidentally had a nuke dropped on it by an American plane.
Oh, God. So,
Yeah. And you can imagine what would have happened, what would have been the response, right? It would have been, oh, we don't have time to investigate and figure out what went wrong. You know, we just assume it's the Russians. But
yeah, or Muslims.
Yeah, well, today, sure. And looking at the whole situation with Syria and Russia and all of the crazy nonsense of NATO being grown right into the doorstep of Russia, just needlessly provocative, number one. And number two, there seems to be no appreciation that I can glean from any of these so-called leaders that things can spiral out of control beyond anyone's intent really quickly. You know, if you go back and look at the summer of 1914, when you had this random black swan event that could have just been a little minor thing, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, and then things very quickly spiral out of what anyone intended to happen. I don't think any of the crown heads of Europe in 1914 wanted World War I to turn into what it turned into. I mean, most of the dynasties of Europe got overthrown, and some of them lost their heads. You know, the Habsburgs, the Romanovs, the Hohenzollerns, the Ottomans. A lot of these dynasties had been around for centuries, and World War I ends them. And I don't think they would have jumped into World War I the way they did if they knew how it was going to turn out. And, you know, my point is just, when you start playing with fire like that, you don't know what might spiral out of control. And you go back and look at World War I, it almost happened several times in the 15 or 20 years before it did. You know, there were several cases where war almost happened between the great powers. So, you know, is this stuff with Syria and Turkey and all that, is this going to be the one that snowballs out of control? I don't know. It doesn't seem like it so far, but it could be. And even if it's not this one, I mean, they keep messing around so recklessly, it could happen, you know, potentially. I mean, imagine an American plane shoots down a Russian plane, or vice versa. How quick could that spiral out of control?
Yeah, it's really amazing the number of people that are saying that, you know, well, Turkey's part of NATO, we have to jump to their defense and the entangling alliances. And I'm gonna read a quote here. Yeah, I've read this before, but this is a full quote, and this is an interview with Hermann Göring around the April 18th, 1946, by a prison psychologist. We got around to the subject of war again, and I said, contrary to his attitude, I did not think that the common people are very thankful for leaders who bring them war and destruction. Why, of course not. Or, why, of course, the people don't want war, Göring shrugged. Why would some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best that he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia nor in England nor in America, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it's a democracy or a fascist dictatorship, or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. There's one difference I pointed out. In a democracy, the people have some say in the matter through their elected representatives, and in the United States, only Congress can declare war. Oh, that is all well and good, but voice or no voice.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the Fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Welcome back to the Dangerous Fiends Freedom History Crossover Show. Before we went to break, I was reading the Hermann Göring quote, and I just want to finish it off. The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. And I think with all the reaction to the recent Paris attacks, and then also with what's going on in Syria and the Russian jet being shot down, I don't know. I see this death march towards oblivion.
Yeah, it's definitely a possibility. I mean, is this going to be the one? I don't know. I don't know. But it certainly looks ominous.
Yeah, definitely. And people have this idea that, you know, these great leaders that we have, I mean, the Constitution confers both authority and capability, and by virtue of getting an election and having the magic swearing-in ceremony, that these leaders have these special capabilities, and it's really not the case. And I don't really see World War III as being the cunning, calculating decisions of the New World Order, lizard people gonna enslave all of, you know, what's left of humanity. I really see this as a bunch of idiots that are really in over their heads and have absolutely no clue what they're biting off.
Yeah, you got a bunch of people who drink their own Kool-Aid in a way. You know, they read their own hype and believe it, and they think that they're special and magical because they won some popularity contest called an election and had a magical ceremony called a swearing-in or whatever. But there's a lot of reason to suspect that not only are your average leaders morally below your just general run-of-the-mill person, but they're intellectually below as well. There was a study a few years back where they quizzed a whole bunch of just random Americans on sort of basic American history and economics and things like this. And as you would expect, the average Americans did terribly. But then they gave the same test to a group that just consisted of elected politicians, and the elected politicians did significantly even worse than just the random group of average regular people. I think, you know, maybe the regular people did like a 58% on average, and say the politicians got, you know, 20% lower than that on average. So they're less competent than we are, as flawed and imperfect as we are. They're not better. They're actually worse.
Yeah, well, it's a whole cult of personality. I want to get in one more listener question before we end for the night. I think this may have been Merrick. I would like to hear his thoughts on the new counterculture movement, which largely embraces some form of anarchism or voluntarism, and how it can effectively use history as an educational tool when talking to status. I know he did an excellent show on counterculture, but many of your audience may not have heard. So, yeah, that was a very good episode. But how do you think the new counterculture movement is going to be working?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because, on the one hand, it's a very hopeful sign. When you look around, there's certainly more people than ever before who are talking about these ideas and who are even like making some changes to their life to opt out of the system and to have more personal freedom in their daily life. But then on the other hand, it is a small minority. So kind of balance optimism with pessimism, I guess. On the one hand, there's some great stuff going on. There's some great people doing wonderful things as far as all this goes. But on the other hand, there's still a heck of a lot of people who are just completely asleep at the wheel and clueless, and are not only are they not trying to maximize their personal freedom, they're going backwards, and they don't even seem to realize or care very much that they are. How it all shakes out in the long term, I don't know. But I do think learning history, learning your stuff, that is an important step, an important tool in trying to persuade other people to think about things differently.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show tonight, CJ. It was a pleasure. I look forward to talking to you in the future. And everybody, go check out the Dangerous History Podcast. The website is profcj.org. That's prof, P-R-O-F, cj.org. And for more Freedom Fiends, go to freedomfiends.com. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Worms.
Wines.